Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 132 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Peter Konechny, and I'll be hosting today because our guest is Daniel Sobalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. One of the enduring images of the Middle Ages is the monk, and I think few people these days can relate to how they lived. What did it mean to be a monk or a nun, and how can their lives apply to the modern world? So Danielle has written a new book, How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, and we're going to talk to her about that. Hi, Danielle.
Hi, Peter. It's so nice to be a guest on my own podcast today.
Indeed. You're on the other foot.
I know. I'm a little bit nervous.
So we're talking about your new book coming out right now, around now, and I think it's really, really unique. I've never, ever read anything that's both a guide to understanding how monks and nuns actually lived, and is combined with a kind of a self-help based on medieval wisdom and medieval teaching. So how did this book come about?
Yeah, it's a really unique concept, and I can't take credit for the concept. That actually came from Abbeville Press, and I'm guessing from my editor, Lauren Buca, but I'm not sure, 100% sure who came up with it first. But Abbeville Press approached me because they had come across my articles before and recognized the style that I had, kind of a friendly style of getting history across. And they wanted to know if I wanted to write this book called How to Live Like a Monk. And so I thought this would be a great idea. I knew some things about monks going in, but I thought this would be a good opportunity to learn more about monks because they're very interesting. And then also bring it together with some of the other things I like to read about, which are wellness and psychology. So it was fun to bring these two things together as a historian. It was a good project, and I'm really happy that I was offered the opportunity to write this book.
Now, you mentioned in the book that this came about just before COVID kind of hit us, but I wonder, how was the experience of writing it through COVID?
Yeah, so they came to me with this idea in February of 2020, and it took us a couple of weeks to go back and forth because I wanted to make sure that I had a read on them. I'd never worked with Abbeville Press before, and when you're writing about something like monks, you want to be really respectful of the fact that these people have dedicated their lives to a faith. And so it is kind of a poppy, fun book, and I wanted to make sure before I took on the project that we were both on the same page with the fact that even though we're talking about monks and it's fun, I still wanted to be respectful of this faith. And so, you know, after a few weeks on email going back and forth, we made sure we're both on the same page about this. And just as we had decided we were going to go forward with the book, that's when COVID-19 hit. And so it was actually on hold for a couple weeks while we still figured out, like, can this go to press? So yeah, it was a project that was deeply entrenched in the pandemic. I wrote it during the pandemic. And I think there's nobody who was writing during the pandemic that wasn't thinking about it. So when you're thinking about the solitary existence that monks had, or anchorites too, I don't think that there's any way to write a book about how to live like a monk without considering how it is during the pandemic. And some of the things are really infused in it. So I was really thinking about how monasteries came to be, at least in the Christian West. And they really started out as an idea where you had hermits that were out and trying to resist all temptation and be very saintly. And they recognize that it's actually very difficult to do that by yourself. And I think this is something we recognize now, having lived through a pandemic. It can be very difficult to reach your goals if you're all by yourself, or resist temptation when you're all by yourself. I mean, like, how many of us just binged and binged on Netflix?
I know. it can be really hard to work. Some people can thrive on that, but many of us need some form of social interaction, and it's hard to do that when you're, you know, kind of quarantined and can't go out. And so, yeah, it can be a real challenge.
Yeah. And so the idea behind monasteries in general was everyone got together to face these challenges together. They did it as a team, right? So it might be hard to resist temptation by yourself, and it's much easier to do it when you're together. And so this was something that was really kind of informed by the pandemic, of my way of thinking about this, the monastic community as a community that was working towards goals and doing it more easily as a team.
So you make it clear, like, this is not a book about how to become a monk. That you're not trying to convince people to join into a monastery.
No.
But you're trying to take, like, some aspects of their lives and kind of apply it to today. So what are you trying to do here?
Well, it's kind of a mind freak in some ways, because the austere life of monks was meant to kind of acknowledged the fact that we are all sinful people. And so it was to acknowledge this difficulty that we have in ourselves and trying to purify ourselves of that. And positive psychology today is about, you know, you're all right the way you are. And so you are worth all of the good things just the way you are. And so bringing these two things together is what I was working on in this book, and finding the ways that monastic habits actually made for a healthy lifestyle, even though the philosophies between like modern psychology and medieval monasticism might be different. So the whole goal of the book is to look at monastic habits, ways of life, ways of thinking, and see how that actually has been shown through science, at least some of these ways, to make people live a healthier life. So how can we bring these two things together? So that is the purpose of the book, is helping people to live better lives by looking at examples from history.
And one of the things you kind of set out is a sense of purpose. That was one of the kind of main goals of being a monk, is to have this particular sense of purpose, which was?
Yeah, you can't be a monk if you don't have a sense of purpose. I think you can't be a comfortable monk if you don't have a sense of purpose. So people are joining the monastery in order to serve God with their whole lives, with their whole hearts, with all of their talents. And so that drives them, that goal drives them in all of their daily activities. They're all structured around that. So if we're trying to find an analogy for modern life, a lot of people who talk about success or ways to reach your goals talk about really being in tune with your values. What are you all about as a person? What are you looking towards as a person? And so we can reach success in the same way that monks did if we keep our goals in sight. What are we trying to achieve? And then we build our lives around these goals, whether it's, you know, success in terms of career or in family life or whatever your goals are, whatever your values are, putting that at the center of your life and building your life around that. It's similar to the way that monks build their lives around their faith. And so I've kind of brought these things together in the book to find ways that we can learn from these monks to put our goals to the forefront and our values to the forefront, and find ways to meet those goals in a way that's healthy.
So they're trying to make these goals, but what are the ways are they trying to get to them? Like, how is it being a monk gets you there?
Well, a monk's goal is salvation. First and foremost, you're hoping that at the end of your life, you get to heaven. And so you've lived a life that is pure in that you have tried not to sin too much, that it's been selfless in that you've meant to serve God, that you've been obedient to the abbot, that you've helped the community. And hopefully at the end of your life, you've reached salvation. And so how do they structure their life around this? Well, they spend a lot of time in prayer. They spend a lot of time working. They spend a lot of time helping each other and also helping the community. And because this is in line with their goal of salvation, this works pretty well for them. So again, if we're making it kind of analogous to modern life, if our goal is to live a life that's moral, we might also be doing things like volunteering in the community. If our goal is to live a life that puts our family at the center, then we build our time and routines around that. So it's having these goals as a monk, you would be spending your time in prayer. You'd be spending your time giving to the community and being selfless. And that's how you reach the goal of salvation, hopefully, at the end of your life.
Part of the way that these monks kind of reach these goals is through the rules they have to kind of follow. And one thing I really enjoyed about your book is that we've read a lot about St. Benedict's rules and a kind of monastic rules. Here's what they are, but you do a really good job digging deeper into what they kind of mean. Like, why are these rules coming about? So where did you come like, hey, I want to think about how these rules and what they actually mean for life?
Well, St. Benedict, and I do say this at the end of the book, he would absolutely hate this book. St. Benedict wanted people to have a life that was continually focused on salvation, on the fact that at the end of your life, God is going to judge you. So how are you going to live your life in a way that pleases him, that lives up to what his expectations are for you? So the rules of St. Benedict, they're really great in that they give you so much insight into what his thoughts were on the way you should structure your life. So he tells you all sorts of things like, this is the time that we should all be praying. This is the time we should all be reading. We should be reading with no interruptions. When we hear the bell, we should go to our work, and we're not supposed to laugh. Like, no sparking frivolity is how he puts it. So like, all of these rules, they're interesting because they're based, I'm sure, on experience that St. Benedict had in trying to round up all these unruly monks and help push them all in the right direction to him. So it's very, they're very interesting as a collection, and I definitely wanted to put them in here. Although I think that most modern people would not want to live by the rules of St. Benedict, and that's perfectly okay. I don't either.
Yeah, I don't. We could follow St. Benedict's rules, but I think there are some really good ones in there. Like the one about not being so cranky.
Yeah. Okay, so this is a fun one because St. Benedict mentions a few times in his rule that grumbling is one of the worst things that you can do. So like not only no frivolity, like no joking, but also you shouldn't be grumbling. And he does this not just because he doesn't want to hear people complain, although he's probably sick of hearing people complain, obviously, but it's mostly to help people keep their eye on the goal, right? Keep your eye on the ball. It's meant to not make it more difficult for people. So signing up to be a monk means you're going to be signing up for a life where you have the same food every day. You get woken up in the middle of the night to pray. You never get enough sleep. You never get to speak with your friends as much as you want to. So it's a difficult life. And what he's saying by no grumbling is if people start to grumble and they start to concentrate on the fact that this is a difficult life, nobody's going to want to do it. It's going to make it extra hard for people to meet that goal, for people to stay in the monastery, for people to work together. And so the grumbling thing is not just because he doesn't like whiners, although he really doesn't like whiners, but it's also to keep people's thoughts positive so that they can reach their goals. We know that when we have negative self-talk, we can't possibly reach our goals. It makes it really, really difficult. And so some of the things I bring into the book around grumbling are things like, you really have to pay attention to the type of media that you take in. Is it always negative? Because if it's always negative, it's going to make it hard to get up in the morning. And you want to think about the people that you have in your own community in life. Are they always negative? Because if all they do is complain, it's going to be really hard for you to break free of that and to reach your own goals. So I kind of pull St. Benedict and his idea of grumbling into the scientific research that's been done on positive self-talk or having a community that supports you in your goals. So yeah, St. Benedict, he really hates grumbling, and it makes a lot of sense because it really works against any success that you might try to have in a monastery. You can't have people who are just complaining all the time, even though it's hard. It's already hard without complaining.
Yeah, oh yeah. I know I try and avoid people that are negative and dour, have that kind of like bad outlook on life because they all affect you, right?
I mean, you shouldn't drop your friends. Don't drop your friends if they're having a bad time.
No.
But if the only thing that comes out of people's mouths are complaints, then those are people that you might need to spend a little bit less time with, especially if you're trying to achieve something difficult. You need to have positivity. You need to have positive self-talk. And the stuff that's coming into your mind and into your ears should be more positive if you want to be more successful.
And I think another kind of aspect he stresses in the book is the idea of moderation.
Yes.
What is it moderation in a medieval monk's life or a medieval nun's life?
Well, I mean, I start that section of the book with a quote from Oscar Wilde that says, "Everything in moderation, including moderation." And I think this is true in monastic life as well. And it's funny, you're smiling, but if you had St. Benedict meet Oscar Wilde, they would have absolutely loathed each other. But I think that it's worthwhile having this quote from Oscar Wilde in it because in a monastery, they recognize the fact that you could push yourself too hard in the pursuit of your goal. And doing that was actually very detrimental. So like he would push you hard and then you get sick and then you couldn't actually complete any of your monkly duties, your monastic duties. And so it's not worth it to overwork. So they did have release valves sometimes. Like they would have games that they could play within the monastery. They would go for walks. Sometimes when they were getting their blood let, they would have a day off or 2 days off where they could just sit with friends and chill out. And that time you could spend, if you're in the infirmary or if you just had your blood let, you could spend this time to recover so that when you came back to your work, you could do it with a lighter heart. You could do it with renewed energy. So there's lots of times where monks actually let loose a bit. They might drink too much, for which they might have penance, but they might not have penance. There's a couple of get out of jail free cards and that. But yeah, it wasn't all hard work, and it couldn't be all hard work because then the monks would burn out. And I think that's definitely something that we should learn from monks, that recognition that even though your goal might be really worthy, it's not worth burning yourself out over because it's going to take you much longer to get there and you're going to be much less healthy physically and emotionally.
Yeah, like monks, we have groups like Cistercians and Benedictines and Cluniacs, Franciscans, and they all have a slightly different, I would say more than slightly different outlooks too. And so it's really interesting to see how they come up with these solutions to the challenges of, hey, what should I spend my day doing, right?
Yeah, and not all monks are created equal, right? So we have differences of opinion as to how austere the life should be. And you're mentioning the Cistercians. Those are the people who wanted to have the most austere conditions as monks and nuns as well. I'm saying monks a lot, but we should recognize that nuns were also a big part of it. I'm just saying monks because that was a shorter title, but we need to extend that to monks and nuns as well. But yeah, there are different ways to be monks, and they, you could choose what one suited your personality best or suited the amount of stamina you had best. I mean, we know that monks were always getting chastised by heads of their order, by the Pope saying, you know, they're too lax on this. They have pets. You know, this person, I saw this person snuck a monkey into the monastery, or they have fires instead of having like just one fire over here, or their robes are too nice, they're fur lined. So monks are human beings, and they made a lot of mistakes. They bent a lot of rules to make this life work for them. And so, you know, it's fun to look at this from a modern point of view and see the different ways that I think of monastic vows in some ways as being like New Year's resolutions, and the ways that we try and get around them, where we're not like, we're not breaking our vows, but at the same time, we might not be completely following them in the spirit in which we made them. So yeah, not all monks are created equal in what they were trying to achieve or the ways they tried to achieve it.
I noticed a lot of times when we look at monks, we look at how they get chastised and judged by the church, like the bishops come and make their visits and people complain about the monk lifestyle and things like that. But to me, it's just very interesting to see how they react to the challenges and, like, you know, what level of austereness they have to kind of face. I guess there's no typical kind of monk, is there?
No. I mean, just like there's no typical type of person, right? Everybody's personalities really changed how they faced their challenges as a monk, right? So some people like their sleep more, so maybe getting up in the night was the most difficult challenge for them. And some people like their food more, so maybe having a relatively bland diet. And this is not to say that medieval food sucked. It's just that monastic food was simple. So, you know, that might have been one person's challenge. The fact that you weren't allowed to gossip or you weren't supposed to gossip, that might be someone else's challenge. And so you do see all these different personalities within the monastery meeting these different challenges, the way Saint Benedict tries to corral them. And when you look at that at a human level, it's very familiar to, you know, us facing our challenges, like whatever our goal might be, trying to be healthier, trying to like make more delicious meals or something. You can see the ways that some things are more challenging for us in our own lives than others. And it's definitely something that you can see in monastic communities as well.
Another way that monks can kind of differentiate is what they actually do while they're in the monastery, right? We have ones that will become chroniclers, and others artists, and others tend to the garden. And then we've got like our managers seem to enjoy the business side of it.
Yeah, that's your favorite side of it for sure.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. I'm all for the high management, ruthless business aggression of the medieval monastic community. But yeah, like you talk about the ways they can be, all the options, the way they can be productive, right? Like mm-hmm. what they do on a day-to-day household. Can you just talk a little bit on that?
Yeah. So they were doing some things that were useful for their own day-to-day functioning, right? So there were always jobs to do that would help keep the monastery going, whether that's growing food or it's using your talents to perhaps carve something or repair something. Maybe you're working in the scriptorium. So there's always jobs that you needed to do to keep the monastery running. And for most monasteries, the idea was to be as self-sufficient as possible. Now, a lot of monasteries had lay brothers and lay sisters who were people that didn't take the full vows of monks and nuns, but they were a support community. But then you have other groups like the Cistercians that tried to be really self-sufficient, although a lot of them still had a lay community helping them. And so they had to do work every day. Work was part of their vocation. You were meant to work, and that work was a good thing. There are some monasteries that spent less time working and more time praying, and that's all right too. It all depends on how do you get to your goal? What's the goal? How do you get to it? And so there's that. They also spent a lot of time working for the community outside of the walls. So sometimes that involved chronicling. They wanted to make sure that they recorded events for posterity. So that's really helpful to us as historians, right? We get all this information from them that was meant for posterity. And what's interesting about chronicles is the way that they write them is not only meant to tell you a record of what happened, but it's meant to tell you how God's will worked in the world. Right. So we talked on a previous podcast about Jocelyn of Breakelow and Hugh Quaitlake from Bury St. Edmunds.
Indeed.
He chronicles a lot of really interesting gossip. So everyone should read his chronicle. But one of the things that he talks about that I mentioned in the book is there's a fire at Bury St. Edmunds and it damages the shrine a little bit. And the abbot frames this as being like the result of people complaining too much about their life. And Jocelyn says it's so that we could move the shrine to a better position so that more people could see it or appreciate it. So the chronicles are interesting in that they're meant for posterity for us to learn the facts of what happened, like the fact that there was a fire, we tried to put it out, but also to see how God works. So Jocelyn's explaining to us in hindsight that this is how God works. Sometimes he might send a fire, or the fire that happens is a way for us to improve our shrine or things like that. So chronicling was a way to reach out to the community and a way to reach out to posterity, which I think is really interesting. And this is something that I draw parallels to in the book. Because remember, I'm not trying to get people to live as monks. I'm trying to get people to learn from monks. And one of the things that we can learn from monks is this idea of chronicling, writing things that have happened to you, is actually very therapeutic. Like, there's lots of studies that tell you that it's a therapeutic thing for you to do yourself, writing down what has happened to me in my life and then making sense of it as a narrative. So this thing happened to me in order that this thing could happen to me. And this is just something that, in terms of mental processes, humans find very enlightening and very helpful and very therapeutic. So you can write a chronicle. I mean, we're living through something huge, right? We're living through COVID-19 as well as climate change and all of these things. We can write these things down in a journal, and it's a way of kind of exploring it, making sense of it. We might do that for ourselves and we might do it for the community. And that's kind of an interesting lesson I think we can learn from monks.
Oh, yeah. I think being able to explore and talk about yourself, tell your story, and that doesn't necessarily even have to be the journal. Like, people do TikTok, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Jocelyn probably would have loved TikTok, I think.
Oh, he would. He would. I think many monks would have loved TikTok. And
you know, there are probably monks doing TikTok right now. I do want to mention the fact that monastic living hasn't gone anywhere. I look at medieval monastic living because, you know, I'm a historian. Mm-hmm. But we should recognize that there's still monks living by the Benedictine rule right now.
Oh, yeah. I know at like University of Toronto, the Pontifical Institute of Medieval Studies, there are monks that help out with that organization. And they still can serve a very great role in today's society. Mm-hmm. But hey, one thing I really enjoyed about this book is you talk about the ways the monks kind of figure out ways to help themselves, you know, achieve their goals, achieve what they want. And like one thing I really liked was how you talked about they developed physical space. You know, what is like to live within the walls of a monastery? Because they kind of choose to be a particular type of building, but there are reasons for it. And can you tell us a little more about like why are they choosing it and how can it be useful in today?
Okay, so everything within a monastery was meant, again, to help them achieve salvation, to help them keep their mind on God and on Jesus, on his sacrifice at all times. So inside the monastery, we think about monks as having an austere life, but that didn't really extend to their decoration. So especially during the Gothic period of architecture, you do have really interesting sculptures, you have very ornate ornamentation inside, and things like the tools of the mass, right? The chalice, they're all very fancy. And you do have paintings inside. All of these things are meant to keep the monk kind of on track so that when they go into the church, their mind is on God. They have all of these things to remind them throughout the day within the monastery itself. So there's crosses everywhere. And again, this is all meant to keep the focus. And what I think is really interesting about this, and this is a connection that I make that I think people might be cynical about, but I think there's something to it, that more and more in the books that people are writing about success, the people who are attributing success to things, or the psychological experiments people are taking on, suggest that if we actually have our goals in front of us in a visual medium, we might be more successful. So people are doing this everywhere. They're doing it in the form of a vision board. I'm not comparing, you know, the inside of a church to a vision board to make fun of it or to say that a vision board is unequal to a church. What I'm saying is we use vision boards for the same purpose, where we put them in a place that we can look at and they remind us of our goals and they keep us focused on them. So people are using vision boards today, not for religious purposes. I think it's distinct from faith, so don't at me.
Okay.
But I think it does serve the same purpose in some ways, where we have a visual representation of the things we want, and that reminds us to keep focused on those goals. And so for us, it might be people are getting really specific in their vision boards about like a patio set. You know, I want this, my backyard to look like this. Monks instead were showing pictures of heaven, where they were showing pictures of hell. And so when they went into the church, they would be looking at, this is what I want. I want to achieve salvation. I want to be right there on the right hand of the angels. And this is how I do it. I'm always reminding myself of this goal. So again, I'm not trying to be trite here with the comparison to the vision board, but it kind of achieves the same thing in that when you put your goal in front of you, it helps keep your mind focused on it. And that's, I think, what you're getting at when you're talking about the inside of a church.
Indeed, like the colors, use of light. One thing I remember reading was the use of gold in writing, in books and things like that. And it was discovered that when it was shown under candlelight, and often a monk's going to read under candlelight, that gold can have a really interesting effect on the light. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they do have those kind of visual markers in mind too, right? They want to have things that pop out at them.
Yeah, exactly. And it's all there to help them worship too. Like, it's not just like, oh, I'm focused on my goals all the time, but to recognize the things that are important to them. So it's not a one-to-one with a vision board, but I do think it's interesting that we as human beings do better when we do have a visual representation of the things we want in front of us. And so it works very well to have this in your church, these sculptures, these paintings, these images of the salvation that you're looking for, that you're working towards as a monk.
And I think one of the things that you point out is the use of green and also just plant life within the monastic. And I'm going to take as my lesson from reading this book is I really need to get plants in my house.
You do. You really do. Okay. So I think this is very interesting. So this is kind of where I start the book after I mentioned like how monks live their daily life. I get into plants because plants are a huge part of not only monastic life, but medieval life in general. But it's interesting in monastic terms, because the cloister, which is the part within the monastery that the monks stuck to. So within a monastery, you'd have space for pilgrims, visitors, lay brothers and sisters. But the cloister is that part that monks and nuns are supposed to stay in and not really leave. And so that's usually a rectangle or a square. And in the center of those buildings, making this square, is a cloister garth, which is usually a lawn. So if you've seen a monastery before, or even some cathedrals, you usually see a cloister garth, and they're meant to be green lawns, in part because monks found that this was restful for their eyes. So we shouldn't assume that monks were always living in the dark, like cave dwellers or something like that. A lot of monasteries have a lot of windows, and churches have a lot of windows, and as you say, there's candlelight. But that said, there's a difference between being indoors and outdoors. So that outdoor time that monks had in the cloister garth, they spent in the green, and they found this was very healing. They thought because green was halfway between black and white. So they thought this was a reason that it was restful. But we know from science, and there's so many really great experiments about this, that people are healthier when they have exposure to plant life. And so, I mean, it's great to have your bare feet on grass. That's amazing. But even just looking at a picture of a plant is going to make you healthier. So say you work in a cubicle. You can have a house plant that's live. You can have a house plant that's fake, or you can have a picture of a plant, and all of these things are going to make you healthier overall. And this is really interesting because, I mean, we always talk about plants as being great for lots of reasons, not the least of which is they help us with our oxygen and carbon dioxide. But it doesn't even have to be a live plant to really help you. So this is another thing that monks understood long before we understood, that you need to have plants around you. They're healing for you and not just your eyes after spending all that time in the scriptorium.
I may just switch to having a picture of a plant. That's easier to take care of.
Make a plant your wallpaper on your computer or on your phone. I am like totally serious.
That's true. That's true. And I remember that some medieval monks would use a green gemstone as something to look at when they got tired. Just, you know, I'm going to take a break and just kind of look at this green gemstone. They really like the color green as this kind of neutral color of all neutral colors.
So. Yeah, it's healing for the eyes.
Are there any other kind of lessons that you're hoping the reader gets out of reading this?
Well, I'm expecting that readers will get out of this that they don't want to actually be monks, and that's perfectly okay. But what I'm hoping they get from this is to learn little things about monastic lifestyle that we can use that are going to make us healthier. And one of those things is totally different from monastic lifestyle. Monks spend a lot of time focusing on their sins. That's not very healthy. Let's not do that. Let's learn from them, but use the science, and there's a lot of science within this book that adapts these ideas. So we recognize the fact that a lot of the things that monks did were healthy. How does this work in our real lives? So I'm hoping that people feel better about their own lives having read this, that there are small ways that we can improve our lives. And maybe it's stickier. These wellness ideas are stickier because I've brought them together with monastic life. But one friend asked me, what is the best thing or the most important thing that I could take from this book as a reader? And I would say the healthiest habit that you can take from this is going to be meditation. Writing this book really brought this home to me, that meditation, you don't have to do a lot of it and you don't have to do it every day, but the benefits from it are immense. So a lot of us are struggling right now with COVID-19 and stress and lockdown and all the things. And so maybe if there's one healthiest thing I can mention to people who are reading this book is to consider meditation, because the results that people have had from it last years. There are some studies that say people who had PTSD were taught how to meditate just a few minutes a day for a certain amount of months, I think 6 months. And then after that, the psychologist came back and spoke to them for years afterwards. And for years afterwards, they were able to better deal with their lives and their stresses. So if there's one like healthy, super healthy habit that I suggest people can get from monks specifically, because we all know we can eat healthier, we can be exercising a lot more, but specifically from monks, I think that meditation is probably the healthiest habit that you can pick up. And maybe this book will help you to do that just a little bit.
I think so. And at least you didn't say this to leeches.
I should have said bloodletting. Everyone go let your blood out.
Yes, that too is the good advice, right?
No.
So how can people get this book?
So the book comes out on November 23rd. And I'm super, super excited about this. It comes out in hardcover and it comes out on ebook. And so you can get it either way on November 23rd. I'm also actively recording an audiobook version of this. So that should be out hopefully before Christmas. I will let people on the podcast know as soon as I know the date that that's going to be out. So you're going to be able to get it in all sorts of different ways. One of the things that we haven't mentioned, Peter, and that's cool because we were talking about the content, but this is a picture book. There are 80 manuscript images in it. And so it's a beautiful book, not to mention that there are woodcuts specifically made for this with really adorable monks by Anna Lobanova.
They are so cute.
They are so cute. If you need a tattoo idea, these monks are it. They're so adorable. So I'm really excited about this book, not only because I'm hoping it will help people feel better about their lives and maybe live healthier lives, but it's a beautiful, beautiful book. I'm really happy with all the work that everyone at Abbeville Press put in. And so November 23rd, you should be able to get it everywhere. I mean, there's always Amazon, but Barnes & Noble, Waterstones, Indigo, if you're in Canada, all sorts of different places you can find it.
Indeed. And I've read it. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for talking about it.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad you enjoyed it. And you're not just faking, right?
No, and I actually did read this. Now that you kind of finished this book, you're just about to start on something completely different.
Completely different. Yes.
And tell us about what's happening with you. When this podcast is going out, where will you be?
When this podcast comes out, I will be on an airplane or almost on an airplane flying to Los Angeles, my first trip to Los Angeles, because I'm going to be doing a live stream on Twitch, on Amazon's Twitch channel, which is called Crown. It's called Simulation Mode. That is the name of the show. It's going to be a 2-hour live stream that's based on the new version of Age of Empires. So Age of Empires 4.
And this is like a medieval fighting game, right?
Yeah. So Age of Empires, if you haven't played it, it's had several iterations, and this one is medieval. It's based on the medieval world, and it's got civilizations from Europe to Asia. It's got 7 different civilizations in it that you can play and try and like conquer the world. Simulation mode is called simulation mode because on this Twitch live stream, we're going to have 4 fighters who are going to be dressed as people from Age of Empires, and they're going to be fighting. And I'm going to be doing color commentary, so it's going to be super fun.
Danielle Sobolski, talking head on TV and going Hollywood.
It's going to be super fun because, I mean, how many people have gotten into the Middle Ages through gaming? And many of them got into history through Age of Empires. So this is amazing. This is an amazing opportunity.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like everyone said, like I got into history through a video game. It wasn't Age of Empires, but it was a video game. So, yeah, I hope you are there and you're going to recruit like a whole bunch of new medievalists.
Yeah, I mean, the gamers are already coming to my Twitter, so that's amazing. So simulation mode is going to be, I think, available to everyone. This is going to be something I don't think you need a subscription for. You can just go to twitch.tv/crown, and it's going to be on November 20th, which is Saturday, from 4 to 6 Pacific time. So I think that's 7 Eastern time where we are recording.
Indeed, indeed. So if you've never tried out Twitch, you have now an opportunity to do so, a reason to go on, to go see Danielle.
Yeah.
And people fight it out too.
Yeah, see people fight it out in medieval armor using medieval weapons. It's going to be pretty interesting. I am really looking forward to it.
Thanks so much for being the guest on your own podcast.
Thanks, Peter. It's been a pleasure to be here.
You can follow Danielle Sobolski on her own website, danielsobolski.com. She's on Twitter and Instagram. Twitter is at 5-Minute Medievalist. And you can follow her on this podcast.
Yes, every week.
And on the website this week, we have a fun little news piece about a coin, a medieval coin discovered in Newfoundland. Mm-hmm. Dates back to the 15th century. It probably wound up in Newfoundland at a settlement from the 17th century, but still a little bit of medieval history for that. And we have a piece by Eleanor Yanaga about her new book, The Middle Ages, A Graphic History. She was really kind enough to write something for us and do a couple of videos for us talking about her book. So she's a lot of fun. So.
Speaking of medieval picture books, if you get one, I mean, get How to Live Like a Monk. If you get two, get The Middle Ages, A Graphic History. I had to say it.
Hey, before I go, I will plug our Patreon. Patreon.com/medievalists. This is a way for you that you can support medievalist.net, the medieval podcast, everything we do here. I've seen a lot of growth, especially in the last couple of weeks. So I want to thank all the people that have signed up. And a lot of you are coming on saying you signed up because of Danielle's podcast. So I want to thank you very, very much. It is a great way to support us. And as we kind of move more to a Patreon supported model for what we do here at medievalist.net, I hope it keeps growing, and I hope you enjoy the items that are available, like the Medieval Book of the Month, Medieval Warfare Magazine, which I'm editor of as well. So I enjoy that on 2 accounts, and I hope you want to support. And again, thanks, Danielle, for being the guest.
Thanks, Peter.
And thank you all for listening. I'm sure you'll be very happy to know that Danielle will be back as the host for the next episode, and I will be relegated back to my 2 minutes.
Well, you had this moment in the sun.
Take care, everyone.
Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Gee Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an amazing day.